Welcome to the deep dive.
Yeah.
We're here to unpack fascinating ideas, make them really clear, really click.
And today, we're getting into something pretty fundamental.
Yeah, something huge. It might actually shift how you think about, well, reality itself.
We're talking about your brain's hidden power. The kind of astonishing idea that what you experience is solid, objective reality.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just out there waiting to be seen.
No, your brain is actually, and this is the key word, inventing it. All the time. In real time.
It's a mind-bending concept. And our guide for this journey is Daniel Yon's amazing book, A Trick of the Mind.
Right. So our mission today really is to understand how. How does your brain do this? It acts almost like a scientist, right? Constantly building theories, models.
Exactly. Like a tireless scientist in a lab constructing these models to interpret everything coming in.
And these models, they don't just cover basic perception, like seeing or hearing.
Oh, no. It goes much deeper. These internal models shape your very sense of who you are, how you understand other people, even fundamental drives like curiosity.
Wow.
And here's the kicker. When these models are good, when they're accurate, they allow for some incredible mental feats. But when they're flawed,
then things can get weird.
Yeah. Then you get surprising distortions. Everything from simple visual illusions right up to, well, grand delusions. It's a real tightrope walk. We'll see the genius in it, but also the potential pitfalls.
Okay, so to really ground this, let's set the scene. Imagine you're part of an experiment, maybe like one Yon describes.
Right. You walk into this lab, maybe down some corridors.
And they start with the questions. The ritual, almost. No watches, belts, rings, earrings.
Checking for pacemakers, any metal inside you from old injuries, shrapnel maybe.
Yeah.
Even asking about lead and old tattoos from certain laissez-faire countries, as Yon puts it.
Right. Or are you pregnant? Will your implant heat up? And that final check.
Do you mind tight, enclosed spaces?
Because you're about to go into, well, Yon calls it a noisy coffin, the MRI scanner.
A noisy coffin is about right. It whirs, it crackles, it whistles, this whole robotic symphony.
And those aren't just random noises.
No. Those are the machine's coils firing powerful magnetic pulses into your head. They catch the echoes, basically, to build a picture of what's happening inside your brain.
So while you're lying there, seeing things, hearing things, thinking, feeling.
The machine is literally capturing images of your brain as it conjures up the contents of your mind in that very moment.
It's like looking at the thing that's doing the looking.
Exactly. Observing the organ that creates your observations while you're observing it. It's very meta.
Inventing reality. That phrase is still echoing for me. It's a massive claim.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you question, well, everything.
It does.
So the book's central analogy must be really important here. The brain as a skull-bound scientist.
Absolutely critical. The core idea is your brain isn't just passively recording stuff like a camera. It's an active scientist stuck inside your skull trying to figure out reality indirectly.
Indirectly.
Yeah, think about a physicist studying subatomic particles. They can't just chat with an electron, right? They rely on indirect measurements, signals, and then they build theories to make sense of that data. Your brain's in a similar boat. It doesn't get raw, unfiltered access to the world outside. It gets signals, and it has to interpret them using its theories.
And that's where the comparison to actual science really hits home. Because science isn't perfect, is it? It's got a history of mistakes, of getting things wrong.
That's exactly Yon's point. Science has a history of failure, as he puts it. Brilliant minds have worked under completely wrong frameworks for ages.
Like astronomers thinking the sun went around the Earth.
Precisely. They made careful observations, meticulously measured the stars, but their underlying theory was just plain wrong. And our brains, in their day-to-day operations, have the same strengths and weaknesses. They build these incredibly rich, complex models.
But sometimes those models are just off.
Sometimes deeply flawed, yeah.
Yeah.
Leading to misperceptions, misunderstandings, big ones.
And that's where it really matters to us, to you listening. If the very way we perceive the world can be based on faulty theories, what does that mean for how we live, how we interact?
This is exactly why it's so crucial. These rich models our brains build, they're our main connection to reality, they're how we make contact.
But if the theories are wrong,
then our perception gets warped, our understanding is skewed, and our grip on reality can become, well, tenuous, as Yon says.
Okay. So how are we going to break this down?
We're going to use Karl Popper's idea of three worlds. It's a useful framework. World one is the material world, physical stuff. World two is the mental world, our inner experiences, agency, thoughts about others. And world three is the abstract world of ideas, science, art, philosophy.
And we'll see how the brain connects us to each or sometimes disconnects us.
Exactly, how it builds theories about each world and what happens when those theories work and when they don't.
All right, let's start with world one, the material world, the seemingly solid stuff around us. You'd think perceiving this world would be straightforward, you know? Mm-hmm. I see, ears hear, simple.
Yeah, it feels simple, but it's really not. Your brain is, like we said, stuck inside your head, and it's bony vault, so its access to the outside world is only ever indirect.
That philosophical brain in a vat idea, kind of. Not literally, but the isolation.
Sort of, yeah. George Harman's idea. It's not that you are a brain in a vat, but your brain's physical isolation is real. Everything it knows comes through filtered, interpreted data streams. It can't just take in raw data and poof, know what it is.
It has to guess.
Educated guesses, yeah. Inferences. And crucially, those inferences are massively shaped by its prior beliefs, its existing theories about how the world generally works.
So it's not just about the new information hitting the senses. It's about what the brain already thinks is true.
Absolutely. Which brings us to a really key concept here. Bayes' theorem.
Okay, Thomas Bayes. 18th century.
That's the one. He was apparently quite obsessed with games of chance, probability. His theorem is basically a mathematical way of thinking about how we make inferences. It says we don't just use the immediate evidence, we always weigh it against our prior probabilities.
Our background knowledge. What we think is generally likely.
Exactly. Your understanding of how likely something is before you even get the new evidence.
That feels a bit weird sometimes. We're often told, just look at the evidence. Be objective.
Right. But Bayesian thinking suggests ignoring your priors, your background knowledge, is actually irrational. It's leaving valuable information on the table.
Give us an example.
Okay. Imagine you're out late looking at the stars. You see a flash. Something darts across the sky. Gone. Looks like maybe a flying saucer.
Okay.
Now, if you only use that raw visual data, you might think, alien spacecraft.
Yeah, maybe call someone.
But your brain doesn't stop there, does it? It instantly pulls in its priors. Okay, yeah. What's likely? Was there a satellite launch on the news? Did my neighbor just get one of those fancy drones? What are the actual odds of an alien visit tonight?
Right. It puts in context.
It calculates the most likely explanation based on everything it knows, the new data, and the background probabilities. It stops you calling NASA every time a plane flies over. That's your brain being a sophisticated Bayesian machine, constantly balancing evidence and expectation. Hashtag 1.2. Seeing and hearing what we expect to see and hear.
Okay, so this theory building, this Bayesian stuff, isn't just for big dramatic things like UFOs. It filters down into everyday perception, like just seeing.
Oh, absolutely. Deeply. We think our eyes are like little cameras just recording what's out there. But if you actually look at the activity in your visual neurons, it tells a very different story.
How so?
Well, the signals firing deep in your visual cortex aren't just a passive reflection of light hitting your retina. That activity is constantly being edited, adjusted, reshaped.
Edited by what?
By what the brain thinks it's seeing. By its predictions and expectations. Not just the raw input. It's an active construction process.
And we can actually see this editing in action with visual illusions, can't we?
Definitely. Take the Kinesa triangle. You know the one with the three Pac-Man shapes?
Yeah, where you see a bright white triangle floating on top, even though there are no lines drawn for it.
Exactly. Now, if you were looking at that in an MRI scanner, neurons that respond to edges would fire along the imaginary edge of that non-existent triangle.
Wow. So the neurons act like the edge is really there.
It's as if they know an edge should be there. Based on the overall pattern, even with no direct sensory input for that specific edge. This shows that higher brain regions are constantly sending predictions down to the visual areas.
Like a sketch, a guess of what ought to be there.
Kind of like that, yeah. A rough sketch based on a hypothesis. And this prediction stream is always running. It makes our perception, as Jan says, suffused with hypotheses and shaped by expectations. Your brain isn't just passively receiving, it's actively editing the neural signals, turning up the volume on expected signals, maybe silencing unexpected ones.
So it's not just seeing is believing, it's more like believing influences seeing. Our brain makes us biased towards seeing what fits our theories.
Precisely. We've even seen this in experiments where people report seeing their hand move slightly before it actually does, just because they intended to move it and expected it. The expectation influences the perception of timing. It's powerful stuff.
And this isn't just vision, right? Hearing works the same way. Our brains remix what we hear based on expectation.
Absolutely. It's the same principle, applying prior beliefs to make sense of ambiguous sounds.
That reminds me of that hilarious story someone posted online about understanding knowledge is power, Francis Bacon, as...
Knowledge is power? Francis Bacon. Yes, that's a perfect, if funny, example.
For years, this person wondered about the profound link between power and, well, Bacon France. And people would just nod along.
It shows how incredibly strong our prior expectations can be, twisting the actual sounds we hear. And speech is inherently ambiguous. The sounds run together. Think about it. Where were you last night? There are no neat silences like spaces on a page.
So the brain has to insert them.
It injects these subjective silences, yeah. Based on tracking the probabilities of which sounds usually follow which others, that's how it parses werewolves live differently from werewolves live, even if the raw sound waves are identical, it picks the more likely meaning based on context and prior knowledge.
Which explains those viral audio clips too, doesn't it? Yanni or Laurel, Green Needle or Brainstorm.
Exactly. Those bistable sounds are fascinating. Just telling someone what word to expect dramatically changes what they hear in that ambiguous signal. It's proof positive that language experience is a blend, a synthesis of sounds and top-down expectations. Your brain makes its best guess.
You mentioned an experiment confirming this.
Right.
With degraded speech.
Right. Ida Sohoglu's work. People listen to vocoded speech, basically. Very muffled, unclear recordings. Before each sound, they saw a printed word cue, like boat or goat. Whoa. And their expectation massively boosted clarity. If the cue matched the muffled word, people perceived it as much clearer than if the cue didn't match or if there was no cue. The brain uses the prediction to clean up the noisy signal.
So it's constantly predicting words, even before we hear them.
Yeah, neuroimaging shows signatures of surprise in the brain when an unexpected word ending pops up, like, the boy went to the beach to dig for clamu. Your brain predicted clams.
Ah, clamu.
And even more, it shows activation for words like baby when someone hears, in the crib there is a sleeping. Before the word baby is actually spoken, it's anticipating based on context.
So context helps resolve ambiguities, like the cross-eyed bear versus the cross-eyed bear.
Exactly. Same sounds, totally different meanings resolved instantly by the brain's predictions based on the conversational topic. It's another layer of reality editing, guided by theory. Hashtag, tag, 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 tag 1.3. The blurred line between perception and hallucination.
Okay, so if the brain is always making these predictions, these theories, what happens when a theory becomes really, really strong, like overwhelmingly strong? Can it start to create experiences, not just interpret them?
That's where things get really interesting and where the line between normal perception and, say, hallucination starts to look, well, surprisingly blurry.
Blurry how?
The argument Jan makes is that they aren't totally separate categories. A hallucination, in this view, can happen when the brain latches onto a false hypothesis, a wrong theory, but holds onto it so strongly that the predictions it generates effectively leak into conscious experience.
They become real to the person experiencing them.
Exactly. They feel just as real as perceptions triggered by external stimuli because, at a neural level, the brain is generating a very similar pattern of activity, just driven internally by the strong prediction.
Can strong beliefs actually generate these experiences?
History seems to suggest so. Think about Marjorie Kempe, the 14th century mystic.
Right, you mentioned her earlier. Visions of demons, then comforting visits from Jesus.
Yeah. After a difficult childbirth, she had these terrifying visions, demons with flaming tongues clawing at her. Then later, Jesus appears in purple silk, telling her she's okay. These experiences were utterly real to her, convincing her and others that she was divinely inspired.
But later interpretations suggest maybe psychosis, like postpartum psychosis.
That's the modern hypothesis. And the connection Jan draws is fascinating. Could her intense religious beliefs, her deeply held theories about heaven, hell, angels, demons, drawn from scripture and her culture, have formed such powerful top-down predictions that they actually generated those sensory experiences? Did she hear God's voice because she so strongly expected to?
Wow. So culture and belief shape even these deeply personal, unusual experiences.
Profoundly. There was a study comparing people who hear voices in different cultures, the U.S., Chennai in India, and Accra in Ghana.
And the voices were different.
Dramatically different in tone and interpretation. In the U.S., often harsh, violent, like strangers tormenting them. In Chennai, often familiar voices, relatives, sometimes cajoling, sometimes critical. But in Accra, the voices were often interpreted spiritually as communication with God, mostly positive, offering guidance.
But clinically, they might all meet criteria for psychosis.
Many did, yes. But the content and the meaning of the hallucinations were radically shaped by their cultural beliefs and expectations. It shows how context sculpts these experiences.
And then you have people who hear voices, but aren't considered clinically psychotic,
yeah.
the healthy hallucinators.
Right, like clairaudient psychics.
Yeah.
They might report hearing voices daily, interpret them as spirits, but they function perfectly well without the disorganized thought patterns often seen in psychosis. Jan sees these individuals as really important.
Why?
Because they help researchers narrow things down. Phil Corlett did experiments where people were conditioned to hear a sound that wasn't there.
A conditioned hallucination.
Exactly. And the tendency to hear this non-existent sound was stronger in both psychotic patients and these healthy psychics. It coincided with specific activity in the auditory cortex, like a virtual input.
So what does that tell us?
It suggests that maybe the core difference isn't some global brain dysfunction, but a specific imbalance, an overweighting of prior beliefs or predictions in perception. By studying healthy voice hearers who have this specific trait but function well, researchers can potentially pinpoint more precisely what goes wrong in debilitating illnesses, rather than just saying psychosis is weird brain activity.
Okay, so the big takeaway here is that this prediction machine is always running. It's fundamental.
It's a feature, not a bug, as Jan says. Without the brain constantly projecting its hypotheses onto the incoming sensory data, just making sense of the world would be, well, probably impossible. We'd be lost in a sea of meaningless noise and light.
Okay, we've looked at how the brain constructs the physical world. Let's move to Popper's second world, the mental world. This is the world of people, minds, intentions, agency.
Right. And just like with the physical world, our brain isn't just passively observing mental states, it's actively building theories. Crucially, it builds a theory of you, a theory of you as an agent who causes things to happen.
And this theory of agency is fundamental to, well, society.
Responsibility.
Absolutely. It's what makes us feel responsible, culpable for our actions. It's why we don't put pigs on trial anymore, like those poor Lavigny pigs in medieval times. We have a theory that distinguishes human agency. But and this is the crucial part again, even our best theories about agency can be wrong, meaning our brain can get confused about who's actually causing an action, even our own actions.
Exactly. It can lead to really distorted models of cause and effect.
Yeah.
We can feel control when we have none, or feel like we lack control over things we are, in fact, doing.
We see this in some neurological conditions, right?
Very starkly. Take alien hand syndrome. Damage to certain brain areas like the frontal cortex or corpus callosum can lead to one hand acting seemingly on its own.
Doing things the person doesn't intend.
Yeah, spontaneously grabbing objects, scribbling. One patient said, "It will not do what I want it to do." Another even tied her road hand up at night. And the patient's brain generates a theory to explain this. They often feel an external force is controlling the hand, even though it's their own brain circuits misfiring.
And the opposite can happen too, anosognosia.
Right. Where patients with paralysis, say after a stroke, firmly insist they can move their paralyzed limb. Neurologist Ramachandran described a patient paralyzed on her left side. He asked if she could clap. She started making clapping motions with her good right hand towards where her left hand should be, insisting, "Yes, I am clapping."
A powerful feeling of control, completely disconnected from reality.
A very strong but false internal hypothesis about her own agency. We also see distorted agency in some psychotic delusions of grandeur, where someone believes they can control world events, for instance.
These are extreme examples, though. Do these illusions of control happen to, well, the rest of us?
Oh, constantly. They're woven into everyday life. Think about craps players throwing dice harder for high numbers, softer for low numbers. They know it doesn't work, but the feeling of influence is strong.
Or pushing buttons that don't actually do anything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Those placebo buttons on crosswalks or elevators. We push them, maybe the light changes eventually or the elevator arrives, and our brain draws a little causal link, even if none exists. Experiments confirm this. Alloy and Abramson had healthy people try to control a light bulb that was actually disconnected. People consistently overreported their control. Their brains generated a plausible but wrong hypothesis.
And we often mix up correlation and causation, don't we? Especially with complex things. Jan calls it the leadership fallacy.
That's a great example. Political scientists find that mayors, prime ministers, CEOs often have surprisingly little direct impact on huge outcomes like crime rates or the economy or share prices. There are so many other hidden factors.
Global forces, market trends.
Exactly, a whole confluence of unseen forces. But our brains naturally gravitate towards attributing change to the visible agent, the leader whose actions we can see. Research suggests these illusions of control often arise from a simple sensitivity to coincidences. If your action happens close in time to an outcome, your brain hypothesizes a link. It looks like control, even if it isn't real.
This feels like it could lead to some really problematic situations if our sense of agency gets distorted.
It absolutely can, and one of the most disturbing examples Jan discusses is facilitated communication.
Right, the therapy for nonverbal individuals, often with severe disabilities, where a facilitator supports their hand on a keyboard.
Yes. In the early 90s, there were seemingly miraculous breakthroughs, like Janice Boynton working with Betsy Wheaton. Betsy appeared to be composing these complex, thoughtful texts, opinions, stories, even jokes via Boynton's facilitation.
But it wasn't real.
It was tragically an illusion. As Jan states, the testimony obtained through FC is itself the illusion. Rigorous testing showed the facilitators, like Boynton, were unconsciously guiding the typing. They weren't deliberately faking it, but the words came from their minds, not the child's.
Unconsciously.
It goes back to those strong prior beliefs and expectations. The facilitators desperately wanted it to work. They believed the child had this rich inner life waiting to be unlocked. This expectation led them to anticipate the child's movements, subtly guiding them without realizing it, creating a profound hallucination of passivity. They genuinely didn't feel they were controlling the keyboard. Their brain's model of agency was completely wrong in that moment.
That's chilling. It led to false accusations too, didn't it?
Devastatingly, yes. False allegations of onus emerged through FC, based entirely on the facilitator's unconscious thoughts. The technique is now widely discredited by scientific bodies. It's a stark warning about how our brain's powerful prediction machine, combined with strong desires, can create a profoundly false sense of reality, both about the world and our own actions within it.
Okay, so our brains build these theories of agency, sometimes getting them wrong. But where do these theories come from? Are they fixed, or do we learn them?
That's a great question, and it touches on big philosophical debates like free will. Chris Frith, who you mentioned collaborating with, has an interesting take. He argues that whether or not free will is metaphysically real in a deterministic universe. The idea of free will, the belief in it, is crucial for societies to function.
For things like praise and blame to make sense.
Exactly. Society needs a shared theory that we are generally in control of our actions and thus responsible for them. Frith points out this idea might go way back, even to Epicurus, who suggested our sense of responsibility is something we learn, something inherited from culture.
So kids learn about control through rewards, punishments, the stories we tell.
Right. They absorb the cultural expectations around agency. I didn't mean to, is a classic example of appealing to this learned theory.
But these social theories can also teach us to feel less control, can't they? Like when we're just following orders.
Yes, definitely. Think about everyday obedience. Paying taxes, buckling your seatbelt, staying late at work because the boss says so. There's a sense you're not fully choosing. You're complying with an external command.
Which brings Milgram's obedience experiments to mind.
The classic study, yes. But a more recent experiment by Casper gives us a closer look at the subjective feeling of being coerced.
How did that work?
Participants delivered what they thought were painful shocks to a partner. Sometimes they chose freely to do it for a small payment. Other times they were explicitly ordered to by the experimenter. The action pressing the button was the same.
But the feeling was different.
Very different. They looked at something called intentional binding. That's the subjective feeling of connection between your action and its outcome. Time even seems to compress slightly when you act freely. Casper found that being ordered disrupted this binding. The subjective link between action and outcome dissolved.
And in the brain, did that show up?
It did. They looked at N1 brain waves, which reflect how attentively the brain monitors the consequences of actions. When participants chose freely to shock, their N1 signal was stronger. They were paying close attention to the outcome. But when they were ordered, the N1 signal was attenuated, weaker.
As
if their brain was processing the outcome, almost like it was caused by someone else. Like an external event, not the direct result of their own action. When only following orders, the brain's experience seems to genuinely shift.
That's huge. And this feeling isn't fixed. Social roles can change it.
That's what another study suggests. They compared private soldiers with officer cadets, people trained for high levels of responsibility.
Right.
The private soldiers showed the same pattern as civilians. Weaker N1 signals when ordered to shock, but the officer cadets, their N1 signals remained high even when ordered.
So their training, their ingrained sense of responsibility, changed their brain's response.
It seems so. Different socially learned hypotheses about responsibility and control altered how their brains monitored the consequences, changing their subjective experience of the same event. It suggests our feelings of agency or passivity aren't automatic. They're shaped by the theories our brain adopts, influenced by culture and training.
Okay, let's shift to understanding other people's minds. The classic problem of other minds.
Yeah.
We can't directly access someone else's thoughts or feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like trying to detect life on another planet, right? You can only see the external signs.
That's a perfect analogy, and Carl Sagan actually used it. When the Galileo probe flew past Earth, he had it turn its instruments towards Earth. Why? Because we know there's life here.
So they could build a model of what life looks like from the outside.
Exactly. What signals does it produce? How does it change the atmosphere? Once they had that Earth-based model, they could use it to search for similar signs elsewhere. Our brains, Jan argues, do something very similar for understanding other minds. We point our probes inward at ourselves. We build a model of our own mental world, how our thoughts connect to our actions, how our emotions feel, how they show up in our bodies. Then we use this inside-out model to make guesses about what's happening inside others.
So we're essentially projecting our own experience onto others to understand them.
In many ways, yes, especially when reading body language. Rosie Eady's research looks into this. We think we're good at spotting emotions and how people move, but it's tricky.
Because everyone's different.
Exactly. How fast do you move when you're happy versus irritated? Eady's idea is we calibrate based on ourselves. We learn the links between our emotions and our movements. Then we apply that self model to interpret others.
Which means if someone moves differently from us, we might misread them.
Precisely. If you're naturally very energetic, my calmer pace might look sad or uninterested to you, even if I'm perfectly content. This is where cultural differences in expression can cause issues too. The boisterous Italian versus the stiff upper lip English stereotype, different movement styles interpreted through potentially miscalibrated self models.
This makes me think about autism. The traditional view was often mind blindness, suggesting difficulty understanding others' mental states, like in the Sally Ann task or the Hider symbol shapes animation.
Right. But this self-calibration idea offers a different perspective, framed now as the double empathy problem.
Double empathy.
Yeah, the idea is maybe it's not a one-way deficit, but a mutual misunderstanding stemming from different ways of being and moving. Autistic people might move slightly differently, maybe faster, maybe with different rhythms. If neurotypical people are using their own movement patterns as the baseline model, they might misinterpret autistic body language and vice versa. Autistic individuals might misread neurotypical cues if their internal model is calibrated differently.
So it's a calibration mismatch.
That's the argument. Rosie Eady and Claire Cook tested this using animations created by both neurotypical and autistic participants. Neurotypical viewers were actually worse at interpreting the social intentions in the animations made by autistic people. They showed a kind of selective mind blindness.
Wow, so it's not necessarily a deficit in autistic minds, but a communication breakdown between different kinds of minds because their predictive models are tuned differently.
Exactly. A mutual miscalibration.
Yeah.
And the broader implication is that misunderstanding can happen anytime our internal model doesn't quite match the person we're trying to read. The solution. More diverse experiences to broaden our predictive models.
It's like learning a language, maybe. Cecilia Hayes uses that analogy.
Yeah, she compares learning to read minds to learning to read print. Behavior is like the letters on a page. We learn the interpersonal alphabet to decode the mind behind the behavior. But different cultures, different individuals, might use slightly different alphabets or dialects.
Another strategy we use is just assuming others are like us. People like us are people like us.
Definitely. The Jim and John political study showed this clearly. People projected their own political views and totally unrelated personal tastes, like enjoying bubble baths, onto fictional characters they perceived as politically similar.
And brain scans showed more activity in self regions when thinking about similar others.
That's right, correlating with how much they projected themselves onto the other person.
But that strategy is risky. It only works if the traits actually correlate.
Exactly. Political views might correlate with tax views, fine. But political views don't determine if you like champagne or fear aging. We can't just assume everyone's mind is a copy of our own. We need to map the actual variations out there.
And if our map is based on a very limited sample of people,
then we get overfitting. Our model becomes really good at predicting people exactly like the ones we know, but terrible at understanding anyone different. Our subjective mind space gets warped.
And this is where prejudice can creep in, not necessarily from malice, but from biased data.
That's a deeply unsettling but important idea Jan raises. If AI models trained on biased internet data can become bigots, showing gender bias in image recognition, racial bias in loan applications, associating Muslims with violence.
Because they just absorb the statistical patterns in the biased data they're fed.
Then it's plausible human brains can develop motiveless prejudice too. Simply living in an unequal world, absorbing its biased patterns, can be enough to wire our predictive models in biased ways without any conscious intent to discriminate. Google Images search results for person reflecting gender inequality is one example. Studies show we even project existing biases onto new, unfamiliar roles.
So how do we combat this?
Well, brain science isn't the whole answer. We need social and political analysis too. But the brain analogy is powerful. If our brains learn like these algorithms, then feeding them biased data will lead to biased predictions. The choice isn't if we predict, but whether our predictive models are wired responsibly or otherwise. Jan's suggestion, we need to deprovincialize our minds.
Explore different corners of mind space. Encounter different kinds of people.
Exactly. Look closely at each other, especially those different from us, to build richer, less biased, more accurate models of the diverse human minds out there.
Okay, final stage of our journey. We've done the material world, the mental world. Now for Popper's third world, the abstract world of ideas.
Right. Art, science, philosophy, music. Things that exist beyond individual minds or physical objects. And the key driver connecting us to this world is curiosity.
That fundamental human urge to understand.
Think of those students in Cold War Czechoslovakia risking everything for forbidden knowledge in the underground university. Or scientists at CERN spending billions on the Large Hadron Collider, not for immediate profit, but for that eureka moment, the sheer joy of figuring out how reality works.
And that same drive makes us want to learn, to read, to listen to things like that.
Exactly. It's a powerful craving to understand.
But you mentioned earlier that this seemingly noble drive might be linked to our more basic appetites, not the separate angel-devil thing.
That's the fascinating twist from neuroscience. Historically, yeah, curiosity was seen as higher, separate from base desires. Plato, Freud, but that split is common. But brain science suggests otherwise. The same neural circuitry involved in craving food or money or praise.
Dopamine circuits.
Largely, yes. Those subcortical nuclei deep in the brain light up for all sorts of rewards, from food to social approval, and even, for scientists, seeing their paper published in a top journal. Those rat experiments where they compulsively self-stimulate dopamine pathways show how powerful this drive system is.
But dopamine isn't just about raw pleasure, right? It's about prediction error.
Exactly. That's the crucial refinement. Dopamine neurons fire most strongly, not just for reward, but for the difference between the expected reward and the actual reward. A pleasant surprise gives a big burst. An expected reward, much less activity.
Like winning the lottery unexpectedly versus getting your regular paycheck.
Precisely. The surprise matters. It explains why hitting the jackpot feels amazing initially, but long-term happiness often doesn't change dramatically after big life events, good or bad. We adjust our expectations. Our sense of value is always relative to what we predict.
Okay, so how does curiosity fit into this reward prediction error framework?
Well, think about knowledge. Is it just useful, instrumental knowledge, like finding the best local bakery? Or is it sometimes non-instrumental, knowledge for its own sake, like reading about bakeries that closed decades ago?
Pure curiosity.
Pure curiosity. Jan uses the Christmas suitcase parable. You accidentally lock a suitcase with a new code, expect a huge struggle to open it. Then you crack it quickly. That's a pleasant surprise, a positive prediction error. But what did you gain?
Information. You learned the code.
Exactly. The pleasure of the surprise is tied to the information gained. We enjoy those eureka moments, Jan argues, because they are signs that we're becoming wiser than before. The prediction error signals learning.
So the brain rewards us for reducing uncertainty, for updating our models.
It seems so. Experiments show happiness is often more strongly linked to these learning signals. Signs our beliefs are becoming more accurate than to the actual rewards themselves. Monkeys will even pay, give up juice rewards, just to get information about the future, whether it's good news or bad. Knowing itself is rewarding.
So that's our wanderlust.
That's the term Jan uses. By wiring pleasure to the acquisition of knowledge itself, dopamine gives us this endlessly renewable source of satisfaction. The world of ideas is infinite. There's always more to learn, more surprising threads to weave into our understanding. Curiosity becomes a drive that's never fully satisfied. Hashtag, tag, 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 3.2 originality from replication.
But wait. If the brain is fundamentally a prediction machine, learning patterns, absorbing data, how does it ever come up with something truly new, something original?
That's the paradox, isn't it? It brings us back to AI, like Google's LaMDA. Was it sentient, as Blake Lemoine felt, or just a stochastic parrot regurgitating patterns from its training data?
It feels like an old question in a new guise. Descartes worried about mechanical automatons centuries ago, arguing only humans had genuine originality.
Right. How can data crunching, pattern matching lead to innovation? Replication seems like the opposite of originality. But Jan argues they're deeply intertwined.
This echoes the nature versus nurture debate in language, doesn't it? Chomsky argued for innate grammar because kids' input seemed too poor. Poverty of the stimulus.
Exactly. He thought experience alone wasn't enough. But then connectionist neural networks in the 80s and 90s, designed as blank slates that just learn associations, started replicating human-like learning patterns.
Like kids overregularizing verbs, saying runned or good.
Precisely. The models made similar errors, suggesting these habits could emerge from learning statistical regularities, not explicit innate roles.
And today's large language models, like GPT, are basically supercharged versions of that.
Supersized connectionism, yeah. Train on vast amounts of text, they learn to predict the next word based on statistical patterns. Their output can be incredibly fluent, human-like.
They love to fool someone into thinking it's sentient.
But fundamentally, it's recombining patterns it learned. Yet, studies comparing GPT's surprise signals to human brain activity while reading show remarkable parallels. It suggests our brains also operate heavily on linguistic prediction.
So where does the originality come from, then? Is it just clever remixing, creative plagiarism, as Jan puts it?
That's part of it. Montaigne used the analogy of bees. They gather nectar from many flowers, borrowed material, but transform it into their own unique honey. Creativity often involves transforming and recombining existing ideas. Donald Campbell talked about evolutionary epistemology, creativity as variation plus selection.
Like biological evolution, but with ideas.
Kind of. And crucially, AI models like GPT don't just predict. They actively introduce randomness into their output. Without that touch of noise, they would just be carrots. That randomness allows for novel combinations.
Sometimes nonsensical ones, like walking across the English Channel in 18 hours.
Exactly. Or clouds having pieces of sound. It's prediction plus random mutation. And Jan suggests our brains might work similarly. We track patterns, but there's inherent neural noise, randomness in brain activity. That combination allows originality to emerge. We plagiarize and shuffle reality to generate something new.
We see this in how ideas change as they're passed along too, right? Like in Bartlett's telephone game experiments.
Absolutely. His remembering study showed how stories and pictures distort and simplify as they're transmitted from person to person. A drawing of an owl might become a cat over several retellings, shaped by each person's existing knowledge and biases, the filter of their mind.
So if everyone has the same filter, ideas don't change much. But if you have diverse filters,
then you get more mutation, more potential for originality. This is Campbell's fish scale model. He worried about academic silos where everyone thinks alike. He argued for cultivating weird minds, people with unusual combinations of knowledge.
Like seeing connections others miss. Physics principles applied to social phenomena. African art inspiring cubism.
Exactly. By having an unusual blend of knowledge, being familiar with overlaps and fringes, your brain has a unique set of patterns to recombine. You become a unique scale in the fish, contributing novel mutations. Originality isn't about rejecting patterns, but about creatively remixing them through a unique, diverse mental filter.
Okay, we've covered how the brain builds its models, understands others, even generates novelty. But what happens when the world itself seems to go off script? When things become chaotic, unpredictable? This feels relevant to understanding things like conspiracy theories.
It really does. How can seemingly functional people come to believe things like Pizzagate or QAnon, ideas that seem objectively bizarre?
It's baffling.
Jan's answer ties back to the predictive brain. When the world feels unstable and uncertain, our predictive systems can go haywire, making us, as he says, more vulnerable to conspiratorial thinking than we might like to think.
Because our theories aren't working anymore.
Or because the brain isn't sure which theories to trust. Remember, our theories shape our perception. They can make us resistant to evidence that contradicts them. Science progresses through that tension theory versus data. Sometimes surprising data forces a paradigm shift, like realizing the universe is expanding, not static.
But only if scientists are willing to update their theories, not just explain away the anomalies.
Exactly. And our brains face a similar dilemma constantly. How much should we trust our existing model versus the contradictory new evidence? This is meta-learning, learning how much weight to give new information.
Like the hide-and-seek analogy, if your nephew always hides in the same place, one weird hiding spot is probably a fluke. Don't change your whole theory.
Right. A stable system means a low learning rate. Be stubborn. But if your niece always changes spots, finding her somewhere new means she's changed her pattern again. Update your theory fast.
A volatile system demands a high learning rate. Be flexible.
Precisely. And brain regions like the cingulate cortex seem to track this environmental stability. High activity signals volatility, ramps up the learning rate. Low activity signals stability, makes us stick to our existing models.
So when the world feels volatile, our minds become more volatile too, more likely to rapidly adopt new, maybe strange beliefs.
That seems to be the pattern. Historical crises often see spikes in conspiracy theories, the Black Death, the AIDS epidemic, periods of rapid industrial change. Uncertainty seems to prime the brain to latch on to new explanations, however outlandish.
And the COVID-19 pandemic provided a real-world test of this.
Phil Corlett's study at Yale during the pandemic was striking. People reporting higher paranoia also showed more volatile belief updating in a simple card game. And crucially, after the massive uncertainty introduced by lockdowns, people's general belief in volatility increased, even in that artificial game.
So the pandemic uncertainty bled over, making the whole world seem less predictable.
It seems so. And this increased expectation of uncertainty, this higher learning rate, meant that new surprising information, including conspiracy theories about vaccines or microchips, could more easily percolate into people's models of the world. It made minds more susceptible to rapid, drastic belief changes.
Trauma can do this too. A sudden shock makes everything feel less stable.
Yes, a large prediction error, like a sudden tragedy, doesn't just update one specific belief. It can shake confidence in our overall model of the world, making everything feel more unpredictable. This cranks up the learning rate, so even small anomalies might suddenly seem hugely significant. A warm day becomes proof of impending doom.
And this feeling of uncertainty can spread.
It can. Anxious messages, even implicitly, can transmit expectations of volatility. And think about the marshmallow test again.
The test of kids delaying gratification.
Right. Later experiments show that if kids first interacted with an unreliable experimenter who broke a promise, they almost all ate the first marshmallow immediately. But if the experimenter was reliable, most waited for the second one.
So their expectation of reliability, of stability, directly influenced their choice.
Absolutely. It shows that even kids' brains are tracking environmental stability. In an unstable world, grabbing the immediate reward is the rational choice, which also links to socioeconomic factors. Growing up with instability logically fosters different behaviors than growing up with stability.
This brings us back to that matrix analogy you mentioned earlier. The red pill, blue pill choice. See the uncomfortable truth or stick with the familiar reality.
Jan connects this to the neurochemical noradrenaline. It's produced in the locus coeruleus and essentially signals instability or surprise. A surge of noradrenaline makes the brain pay more attention to incoming data, making it easier to update models. It drives that meta-learning, adjusting the learning rate.
So hypothetically, drugs could manipulate this. A drug-reducing noradrenaline
might act like a chemical blue pill, inducing a sense of stability, making you stick more firmly to your existing beliefs, tuning out contradictory evidence. Propranolol has shown effects like this in some studies.
And a drug-enhancing noradrenaline
might be like a red pill, making the brain hypersensitive to novelty and instability, prompting rapid shifts in belief, maybe making you more open to new, even radical paradigms. Ritalin works on related systems.
It's a provocative thought experiment. Would you take a pill to boost your certainty or one to make you more open to change?
It's a profound question about how we want our minds to engage with the world. It echoes people like Blake or Huxley wanting to cleanse the doors of perception, to strip away the brain's models and see true reality.
But maybe the models are necessary.
Jan's conclusion is more nuanced. Our theories are our lens on reality. Even when we study other brains, we're doing it through the filter of our own brain's theories. The key is humility, to recognize our models are hypotheses, always subject to revision. The brain sees the world through its best theory, but it's always engaged in that endless search for a better model. Like Borges' librarian, always seeking the explanation that finally makes sense of it all. #outro.
Wow. That was quite a journey through the way our brains invent reality. We've really taken a deep dive today.
We have. From seeing how the brain is this tireless scientist constantly building and testing theories, not just passively observing.
Yeah, constructing everything from basic sights and sounds to our sense of self, our understanding of others, even driving our curiosity.
And seeing how this incredible predictive power is both a gift and potentially a vulnerability. It lets us navigate a complex world, but also opens the door to illusions, biases, and sometimes profound misinterpretations.
That personal paradigm you carry around, your brain's unique model of reality. It's built from absolutely everything you've experienced. It's the lens through which you see the world.
So maybe a final thought for you listening right now. What are the hidden theories your brain is using to make sense of things as you hear this?
Yeah. Are you running on a blue pill setting right now, sticking confidently to your existing beliefs? Or more of a red pill mode, open to information that might challenge your worldview?
How stable or unstable does the world feel to your predictive brain? And how might that unconscious assessment be influencing your confidence, your decisions, your willingness to consider new ideas?
It's a lot to think about. But the really hopeful part is that the search for a better model, a more accurate theory, it never really has to end.
Keep questioning, stay curious, keep exploring the incredible reality-building architecture inside your own head.
Thanks for diving deep with us.